Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Now he's been a chart-topping musician, a professional athlete, and is a relentless mental health advocate. His new book, The Place That Has Never Been Wounded, is not about quick fixes or chasing happiness. It's about finding that steady core inside you, blending mindfulness, deeply personal stories, philosophy, and an accompanying soundtrack. It's a guide to coming home to yourself. He's also touring the country next month, so we're delighted to welcome Niall Breslin in studio now. You're very welcome.
How are you?
I'm good, and it's funny to have you sitting here in front of me because I almost feel like I've had your heart and soul in my hands and in my head for the last little while. I mean, you've literally poured that into this work, haven't you?
Yeah, I think because I wrote a book before that was obviously quite personal as well. And more, I think that last book was more the coming to terms with what I had gone through. This book is more about those moments that we all get hit with. Everybody gets hit with this stuff. Nobody gets out of this world unscathed. And it's sometimes people go, oh, you shouldn't say that. That is just the truth. We all go through grief. We all go through relationship issues, health issues. Most of our life is grand and go crack and everything's great, but sometimes we get derailed. And this book was about, you know, probably historically with me, when things like this would have happened, I would have went off the rails. And I would have used it as an excuse to go off the rails. Not necessarily just in a negative way with alcohol and drugs or whatever, but with exercise or work or obsessiveness. I do everything except deal with it. And this book is about responding to it rather than reacting to it. And some of the things that have happened, as I said, people who might have read the book will, well, that actually happened to me last year. Or these are universal things. And one of the ideologies and philosophies of mindfulness, and I wouldn't start with this as a philosophy if I had my own ideology, is suffering is universal. It's something we all experience. And ultimately, we've created a society that doesn't let us express that. And we internalize it. And you internalize that stuff, it's very painful. So this book is about not doing that.
And you're at pains to say that throughout the book, and it's a message I often put out there myself, particularly in this health and wellness sphere. Even though you've got all this experience, education behind you, you're saying, I don't have this figured out all the time. I'm not sitting up here in a mountain going, do what I do and life will be great. And I think that's so important. It makes the message way more accessible to people.
No one does. That's one thing I've learned in my work and study is that anyone who comes on and pontificates about the human mind like if it all figured out is not being honest. The human mind, I don't think, will ever be figured out. But the beauty of mindfulness, it's not about figuring out the human mind, it's about observing it. You learn to observe the mind, almost like your own mind, like it's not yours. Like you're able to see it and you're able to detach from it. And there's, I do think really great quotes are quite useful sometimes, but the Shunryu Suzuki quote says, open your front door, open your back door, let your thoughts walk through the house, just don't serve them tea. Like I used to make them like bourbon cream. I was Mrs. Doyle. Like I was pouring tea. I wouldn't let them leave. And that's what happens with thoughts. When they all come together and they all park, they can be overwhelming. So mindfulness is about insight. It's not about relaxation. There is myths around this and it's about being able to watch yourself. Like it's almost not like you. But yeah, as I said, like even, you know, I read your book, especially around things like diet culture. You know, people make these big weighty claims about things without knowing the human or the personality type or the experience of that individual. And it's important to set that out when you're talking about stuff like this. We're not all the same. We all have different ways of coming into the world and different things that I find stressful. You might be going, oh, that's grand. Doesn't mean it's not stressful. It's very important that we do that. So yeah, I didn't want to speak from a place like from hierarchy, like I've all this figured out. And that's the one thing I've learned. The one thing I've learned in all my learning and study is we don't know that much. And I think we have to admit that, and it's okay that we don't. And there's lots we do know, but I don't think we've got full understanding of the human mind.
Let's talk about it then, The Place That Has Never Been Wounded. I mentioned there is an album, a soundtrack to accompany it. So what came first, the music or the book, or was it always a double concept?
The album, the music. The concept actually came first, the Meister Eckhart quote. I always loved that quote. I love the idea of it because it's a quote that says, you know, so much of what we talk about is what we don't have or what we need more of. And I'm a firm believer that there's something in all of us that has got us this far. And it's kind of a steady part. Some people have different names for it. Some people might be religious. They might think it's God. Some people think it's their soul or their spirit. Some people just think it's within all of us. I think it's been in all of us. And that's the place that's never been wounded. So I love that concept. So then I said, how do I write music that relates to that, that feels like it relates to that? So it's not, it's emotive. It settles and creates a mood. And I wrote this music. I was terrified to play it to anyone because, like, I don't know if this is any good. Louise, who's a composer herself, was like, you need to release this stuff. This stuff is actually releasing something in her and me. And I was like, maybe it'll do it for other people. So that was it. And then I felt myself explaining the album so much. I was like, you know what? The best way to explain this is to write a book. Because there's context in a book. Like, I was doing these little social media posts trying to get some kind of context. I was like, no, let's write a book. I didn't really want to write a book because it's a lot of work, as you know. There's a lot of work in it. And I was like, do I have time for this? But then I felt it was absolutely the right thing to do.
And that quote, I've been thinking about it for a long time. I'd never really considered that there's a place within us that has never been wounded, that there's something that nothing can touch, no trauma, no experience, that underneath it all, there's a steadiness. It was a real mind blow moment for me. I'd never really thought that there was a part that remained unscathed, not unshaken, but actually unscathed.
Yeah. And I think, and there's parts of us that aren't, that are, you know, overwhelmed by the world. Like, there's parts of me that still remain very affected by my experiences, that still feel, you know, when you wake up in the middle of the night, when you're sweating, there's still that part of me, but there's another part of me. And I think sometimes, like, I look at these different forms of psychological approaches, like Adler psychology, and the idea that, you know, even the Viktor Frankl psychology of, you know, you pick your own attitude in any given set of circumstances. I never use what I went through as an excuse to treat anyone any differently. I was very aware that there was a part of me that was consistently steady and able to get me through. And I look back at some of the experiences I had, even when I used to play, you know, when I was playing rugby, I was in such a dark place. Like, I don't know what in the name of God got me through that. But I used to always ask, what is it? What's getting me up and what's getting me through this? Playing matches when I wasn't sleeping, you know, self-medicating with Xanax and all sorts before games. Something got me through. And I think in terms of health, we have to empower people to understand that doesn't mean life isn't brutally tough sometimes. It just means there's something that consistently stays with us. And in mindfulness, we use metaphors around the mountain and the lake specifically. And the mountain, in any given season, is bombarded with, God knows, especially in Ireland, 10 different types of weather: frost, snow, heat, wind, rain, constant rain. And the surface is constantly changing in the mountain, but the mountain never changes. It's still the same. And there's a quote that you're not in the mountains are in you. And I always like that idea. So that's what we're trying to say to people. The surface being the emotions, the thoughts, the feelings that we all have. And below it is that steady part of us that's embedded and it's strong. And in mindfulness, we have to be very careful because there's this idea of spiritual bypassing as well, where people go, well, I meditate, so I don't care about anyone else. That's selfishness. That's not meditation. You have to care about those around you. You have to care about your community. You have to care about how people are treated, and you have to care about yourself. It's all interlinked. And I think sometimes in this space, it can sound a little bit, well, I look after myself. So, you know, that's not how community works. Community, we have to care about other people, which unfortunately is why this modern culture feels very difficult for people, because we're not doing that. There's too much division. So yeah, mindfulness is very powerful, but I think it's been diluted and simplified too much in how we communicate it.
Yeah, and people are overwhelmed. People have so much going on. It's like another thing on the to-do list that they just can't get to. And I loved how you even rounded off the book with this reminder, you actually can't do this stuff wrong. Stop worrying about how long, where, what cushion, you know, are you doing it right? You cannot do it wrong once you pull yourself to the present moment as often as you can.
And it doesn't have to be formal. So there's two types of practice. There's formal practice, which is, I'm going to meditate, I'm going to watch the mind, and I'm going to observe the mind, and I'm going to sit with that. That might be 5 minutes. That might just be a 3 minute, like, breathing space, whatever it is. But then there's informal practice, which for me is by far the most powerful. That's the conversation with a loved one. That's taking a walk. That is feeling the present moment and being utterly submerged in it. That's getting people, some people get into cold water. I always joke about that when teenagers ask me, what's mindfulness? I mean, get into cold water. I said, tell me, are you thinking about yesterday or what you have to do tomorrow? They're like, no. I said, that's mindfulness. It's presence. But I think informal practice is really useful. I think, once again, with mindfulness, we have this idea that it's performative, that we show people we're doing it. This isn't a performance. This is an internal place you're going to. It's no one else's. It's just yours. It's your space, no one else's space. And I think it is, to me, a very powerful tool, but it's not a tool that I push on people. It's something you have to come to. And if you think you're living a perfectly balanced life and, you know, you're not being rinsed by the chaos of social media and everything else, brilliant, rock and roll. You don't need it. But if you feel like I do, like I'm a man wearing a badly fitting suit in a culture that does not fit me, then maybe look at going in there and having a look, and don't be so terrified of that mind.
And it's draining, isn't it? It's draining to be constantly projecting into the future and everything that's to be done, or ruminating on the past. That moment in the present is almost like a little recharge of the battery. It's a reset.
Yeah. The dare mind I read takes a you, lot of work, yeah.
Dare I read you a section from your own book?
You dare.
Because I think it just really sums it up so importantly, and especially on a health and wellness show. And the only reason I'm asking you to read it is because I'm going to read a few lines and then skip down to a few lines, okay. Only for time. In a culture drunk on self-improvement, constantly tweaking, fixing, optimizing every last corner of the self, maybe the most radical act is this. Stop. Stop fiddling, stop apologizing, just be. Sit there in the glorious, chaotic sprawl of who you already are and know that it is somehow enough. Meditation doesn't make any of that tidier, but it helps us stay with it. All of it. The beautiful and the unbearable. The silence and the noise. No flinching. No edits, just presence. Life isn't a finish line to cross. It's what's unfolding right now, in the margins and pauses. Live the life in front of you rather than chasing one that's always just out of reach. And I just think that is so powerful, because people still think, myself included by times, but why? Why do we need to be present? And why do we need to have mindfulness? And that's why, because if we don't, we're missing the life in front of us.
I think, to be honest with you, when you read that out like you did there, I think that was me saying it to myself more than trying to tell everyone else to do that. Because I get caught up in this as well. I get caught up in this idea that your happiness lies in achievement, or you have to do more, or you have to prove yourself to other people. That's just our life experiences of maybe, you know, a teacher that said something to you that made you feel insecure about yourself. And we start living it out. A lot of this book is me telling myself that these are reminders. I'm not lecturing to the audience reading it. And I am quite good at being present because I've worked on it. But that does not mean that is my natural state. That is something I have to be consciously aware of. And like a good example of that is you're driving home to Mullingar and you're going to see your parents. You actively make the decision. You pass Kinnegad and the M4. You go, when I get home to them, I am with them fully. Actively making this decision. I have a lot going on in my life. I have a lot to do. But when I'm there and I'm drinking tea with them at the table, that's it. And you really make that decision before you actually enter into it. And that to me is something I have to do and I'm good at. And if I'm meeting somebody, I do my best to go, I have to be fully present with them. Or if I'm doing something, or if I'm writing music, or I'm performing music. And I'm very lucky that I get to do something that naturally brings me into a flow state. And performing music is probably, above sport and everything else I've done, is probably the thing that gets me there the most. So I know what it feels like to be present, and I like it. I like that feeling. It's a lovely feeling. It's a much better feeling sometimes, because sometimes you're being present and you're like, I hate this. This is chaotic. I need to get out of this. I need to distract myself and do something. And sometimes that's what you got to do. Maybe it's too intense. Maybe it's too much. And this is what I'm talking about, is that self-inquiry is, you don't learn that. That's something you have to experience and you have to work with. But I think ultimately one of the big themes of the book as well is we have been taught to avoid the things that make us uncomfortable. And I'm sorry, but that's part of life. You've no right to be perfectly comfortable all the time. No one has. And there's a difference between being uncomfortable and unsafe. And I'm always very clear on that. Uncomfortable is maybe an emotion you don't particularly enjoy. Do you think I like really bad anxiety? I don't enjoy it, but I'll sit with that. I won't let it overpower me. And then joy. And then something joyful happens. And it's just like an amazing feeling. And then you want to hold on to that joy all the time. And that dissipates too. Nothing stays static. And that's the key of this work, is impermanence. Everything changes. The happiness changes. The sadness changes. And we move on to the next thing. And we just stay with it all. And I think that is all I know about the mind. And the other thing I know a lot for sure is that I come back to this time and time again, is the importance of community. It's so important. Like, we know there's a lot about mental health. We just don't know. Honestly, we just don't know the answer to it. It's so confusing. But there's things for sure we know. Good communities and peer support. Like, and everyone listening to this has the capacity. People will go, well, I'm not an expert. You don't need to be. To build a good community, to be a supportive peer, you don't need to be anything, only a decent person. And anyone listening to this, I'm sure they're that. So we all have the capacity to do that.
You wrote a number of very personal stories in the book, from your mom being in hospital to yourself and Louise having a miscarriage. And I almost feel uncomfortable asking you to trawl over that. I felt it certainly in the promo for my own book. People kept asking me what it was like to fight with my parents and leave home at 18. And it felt strange to keep discussing it. But I think it's important to talk to you about it, because we don't often get a male perspective on miscarriage, on our parents being ill. We don't have that openness to heartache in that way.
Yeah, and I thought about it, whether I wanted to talk about it. And there was two reasons I wanted to talk about it. Firstly, I felt that, you know, as you said, even the male perspective, most of my life, when something like that happens, or there's grief, my instinct is to look to everybody else to see if they're okay. That's what I do. I'm a
protector,
sometimes called self-sacrifice or whatever you want to call me. That's my initial instinct. And that was the first time in my life where I was, my sole responsibility in that moment was Louise. That was it. And in that, I was also able to go, how do I feel here? How am I showing up here? Where is this in my body? And there's no framework to teach you how to deal with it. There's nothing I've read since then that has made it any easier. It's definitely made me feel more, connected that other people have experienced it. But it's still a pain you have to go through. And the prime example of why I talked about that was, in the past, that would have left me for dead. I know how I would have responded to that. And I would have acted out. I probably would have been very difficult to be around. But in that moment, I responded to it. And the best way I responded to it was like, I'm going to talk about this. And I'm going to talk about certain elements of it. I'm going to write about it. There were certain elements of it that I don't think we talk about. I think the idea, as I said, and it's no one's fault, walking through a hospital, watching people walking out with their children while you were going in, it was particularly brutal and difficult. But even my mother, that was a really difficult situation for me. And she was, we really were very lucky she didn't die. And she was going in for a routine heart procedure, like a biopsy and whatever the machine is. I don't know what the machine is. Hit her heart, and I had a huge traumatic experience. And she, you know, she ended up in ICU for many, many days. And it was sitting beside her in the bed thinking, she's going to die. And the kind of what goes through your head in that moment, and all the fears and the reversals, because, you know, she's lying there, as said in the book, naked, vomiting, and you're rubbing her back. But there's a really funny story in it where her blood pressure was really low. So I was like, oh my God, like, the doctor was like, we have to get her blood pressure. We can't get her blood pressure up. And someone had stuck an IKEA sticker on the bed, like it was a little kind of half cut IKEA sticker. And I asked the doctor, was the bed from IKEA? And he kind of looked at me and goes, it's like a 100,000 euro bed. It's not from IKEA. And I was like, well, there's an IKEA sticker on it. But the thing is, my mother's blood pressure raised when I said that, because she was like, what are you talking about, you dope? So I think the Nordic efficiency and her son's stupidity kind of saved her life.
And ironically, it brought her back to the present moment.
It did bring her back. She was like, what is this guy talking about? But I just remember, yeah, it's just that moment of, and at that point, you know, this book isn't about grief. It's not about grief. Grief is just something that we all experience. And I think it was really important to talk about. I talked about Vicky Phelan as well, a very good friend of mine and somebody who I'd had these discussions. But grief is the single best subject to teach people how to be present with the people they love. It is the strongest motivation to say to you, there will come a point in your life where you do not have that choice. So now that you have the choice, make sure you choose the right one. So that's why I kind of wrote about it. And in terms of, you know, the miscarriage, that chapter is about love. It's not necessarily about grief. It's about what was real in that moment and what mattered. And I think that was what I was trying to get across. But yeah, I think it's tough writing about these things, but I think it makes them relatable.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a book where you're coming in here like swaying out ways of telling people how to beat anxiety, I'm going like, I don't know. But I'll tell you, these are the things that I go through, like you probably, and everyone else that reads it and listens to it. And, that's just something I wanted to talk about. And from a male perspective, you know, I can only talk about my perspective. My perspective was I felt responsible and protective of my partner, but also deeply heartbroken. And you have to kind of, you have to find a way to navigate that.
Well, thank you for pouring your heart and soul into this book and into this music. I texted you very early on to it being released to say that I was playing it to my 12-year-old daughter at night when she would feel a bit anxious and get those butterflies in her tummy, thinking about all kinds of big feelings. And it really worked. You know, it was a real gift for me to be able to give her. And that's what you want to be able to give people, that connection to the present. So we're going to play out with one of those tracks. You've chosen The Place That Has Never Been Wounded. It is the title of the album and the book. What can you tell us about this piece of music we're about to hear?
Well, the final meditation in the album is this moment where you see something in the distance and you're kind of following it. It's very, very powerful Buddhist meditation. And you don't know where it is, and you're magnetized towards this figure because it just feels so warm and strong and compassionate and powerful. And you keep walking towards the figure, trying to figure out who it is, and you can't keep away from them. You're so curious, and you realize over the course of meditation, this is you. It's you who's been walking towards. This is the place that's never been wounded. It never left you. You're just rediscovering it again. And in this piece of music, there's a moment in the meditation where you rediscover and you bring yourself back into yourself again. And I had to make that obviously quite an emotional, emotive piece of music, but also there had to be a moment in that piece of music that felt like that. You're bringing that person into you again. And then when you walk back out into the chaos and the noise, you have that. You realize that you've found it again. And when people say, I have to find, you know, I have to get that place. And it's there. It's always been there. There's just too much noise and you're not listening to it. You're not finding it. This piece of music is the symbolic of the moment. You find it again. And I think people, especially live, you can see it in the audience. It does get them and it's meant to get them. And that's perfectly okay.
Yeah. This is a very, very special piece of work. The book and the music. The Place That Has Never Been Wounded. A Mindful Journey Home to Yourself. Niall Breslin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Cheers, Claire.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
From Geico Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts, broadcasting from your brain. Tonight's top worry, if something happens to your apartment and you need to, like, stay in a hotel and pay for it, that would be crazy, right? Art Palpitations has more.
That would be crazy, Tammy, but you got surprisingly affordable renter's insurance through Geico, so it could be covered, giving you peace of mind.
Aw, I love a story that ends well.
Next up, love stories. Are they all they're cracked up to be?
It feels good to worry less. It feels good to Geico.